From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in a third grade classroom during a lesson on the civil rights movement. While talking about Rosa Parks, the teacher, Mrs. Minnelli, described segregation on city buses in Montgomery, Alabama. Whites in front, African Americans in the back. A young boy raises his hand. "Where did we sit on the bus?" he asks. The boy is Latino. There is uncomfortable silence. And finally, Mrs. Minnelli says, "They weren't around." Then she just moved on with the lesson. That moment stuck with the boy throughout his life, and the question he asked, which raised broader questions about identity in this country, have shaped his life. Now the question, "Where did we sit on the bus?" is the title of Brian Quijada's one-man show that you can stream through Jiva Theater. It's an electric fusion of beat poetry, Latin rhythms, storytelling, humor, and live-looped original music. And while it makes you think, it is also one of the most gripping and entertaining performances our Connections team has seen. This hour, Brian Quijada joins us to talk about the show, what it means to be a first-generation American. We'll talk identity and more. Brian, welcome to Connections. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
The show is, I don't really sort of use language loosely, so when I say it's amazing, I mean the show it amazed me within 5 minutes of watching it. It's amazing.
Oh, that's very sweet of you to say. Thank you so much. I really appreciate the kind words. It's lovely that this offering, this streaming option is available to wider audiences.
Well, access for the general public is now on sale for $30 and allows viewers to watch anytime during the streaming window, February 22nd through March 7th. So you still have some time. Tickets may be purchased at jivatheater.org, and the video will be hosted on Vimeo. I don't know how to pronounce anything. Instructions for access will be sent following purchase. So there you go. It's a creative way to do it because, you know, I mean, certainly Jiva would love to have you here in person, and I suspect you'd love that too, Brian.
Oh, my God, so much. You know, we were supposed to come in last year of, I think a month into actually when we all went into quarantine, into lockdown, I was supposed to be arriving in Rochester for the first time. You know, I was supposed to have my first garbage plate. unfortunately, that didn't happen. So, you know, I'm happy that at least this has found a way. We've managed to release this in a way to still connect with audiences in Rochester. And, you know, because of this, all around the globe, it's pretty amazing. It's the positive side of this terrible tragedy, you know.
Well, can I start by asking you just to walk us through that third grade moment that really led you on this path? Can you tell us more of that story?
Of course, yeah. I mean, I will say that I don't remember much of my third grade experience. I remember my timetables. I was pretty good at my timetables. But this was definitely one of the other kind of standout memorable moments of the third grade. You know, it was Black History Month, the same month that we're in now. I don't know if anything has changed since when they teach in the public school system, when they teach Black History. But that question, that lesson really stuck with me. And I was surprised. I was looking around to see if, you know, there was a couple few other Latinos in the class. Maybe like there was like two or three of us, but like I felt weird being the only one that posed the question. And when I got that response that they weren't around, I obviously went home, and that led to the history of how my parents came to the United States in the 70s from the country of El Salvador, just south of Mexico, Guatemala, and El Salvador right underneath it. And it led to larger questions of, you know, where does my family fit in this American history? You know, where do I fit? Where does being brown fit on a black and white spectrum that is America? You know, I called it a supernova, right? An explosion of thoughts that. For me, kind of, you know, started a journey into adulthood, right? Like an identity search of who I was and how I fit into this very complicated experiment of a country, you know?
Yeah, and let me ask you about Mrs. Minnelli. I mean, when you think about her answer, they weren't around. I know it hit you hard. Are you, sure. You know, you look back, are you, I don't even know if there is angry. Are you angry about that? Are you disappointed? I mean, like,
no, I've reconnected with her, and she's, first off, she was one of my favorite teachers. She was lovely, lovely, lovely. And at the time, you know, she was, you know, young. I think in the play, I very much dramatized her to be like, you know, a much older woman from Jersey who has a smoking problem. but at the time,
so there's,
you know,
some creative license here.
but you know, she. We've talked about it. We've gone back and forth. We were able to reconnect. She read about my piece in the paper, and we reconnected, and it was a lovely back and forth exchange, and she felt bad. And I don't feel angry because I've tried to do the research. Once I started writing this play, I did the research, and it is a complicated answer, right? It's not an easy answer to give. I mean, the margins of Latino immigrants in the United States in the 1960s was small, you know, they were around, but the answer also is the fact that it's complicated because Latinx identity spans the spectrum of, you know, Afro-Latino to white, Euros passing skin colors, that it's hard to say where it actually Latino would have sat on the civil rights mm-hmm. buses, right?
Yeah.
I'm a lighter skinned Latino man, and would I have passed? I don't know. Some people are like, you're Latino? That's crazy. And other people are immediately start speaking Spanish to me. So I don't even know. but that's why it's complicated. And that's why I don't blame her for not knowing the answer. Because it's a very hard question to answer, mm-hmm. especially to an 8-year-old, you know, it's a very tough thing. I don't blame her. In fact, if she hadn't have given me that answer, I probably wouldn't have written this play. So I have a lot of thanks and gratitude.
No, listen, I hear that. And before I really kind of want to work through the performance, which, like, let's be honest, most people never want to think about their parents making love. And you've got apparently a willingness to do it. We're going to talk about all kinds of things here. But before we do that, just a note on Mrs. Minnelli and what you just said. And I kind of want to be careful as I do this, because I don't want to say that everyone deserves grace or everyone deserves patience. And I understand the urgency of movements, of people who are really struggling to feel understood or respected or valued. I do. And your performance is filled with a lot of different emotions, confusion, urgency, anger, questioning. So I get that. But at the same time, what you are telling us about Mrs. Minnelli is you're showing her a lot of grace. You're saying, you know, she didn't know and really didn't know how to answer it. And you didn't read malice into her heart. You probably read some ignorance and maybe some openness.
Yeah.
But that's a lot of grace. And I've said to listeners on this program in the past that, I don't know, 5 years ago, I used a phrase going back to my childhood, I had heard a phrase that I thought was just a cartoonish way to make a point, and it turns out it was very anti-Semitic. I said it on the air. I said it on the air, man. Like, I could have been, you know, run out of here. And instead, I got emails from listeners who were so kind, who've listened to this program for years, who know me, and they said, I'm convinced that there's no way you know the root of this, so let me help you. And and I was horrified, and I'm like shaking,
sure.
you know. And I've gone there, and I apologize, and but the grace that they showed with me to say, we're not going to assume, you know, something evil or malicious, and we want you to learn, and we're going to give you that space. It's probably saved my career, and it certainly made me feel grateful for that. That I'm not even sure I deserved it. So I just want to ask you, you know, why do you feel like everything that you've grown up with? That you didn't end up looking back at Mrs. Minnelli and saying, hey, you failed me. You failed Latino children. We're here too. Instead of saying,
sure.
you know, I it wasn't a good enough answer, but you weren't trying to hurt me, and let's learn from this.
Sure. I think it comes from a tremendous respect for teachers and the incredible weight we put on our teachers to be perfect. You know, I before, you know, in the show, I talk very briefly about how when I went to the University of Iowa to try to appease my parents, I went to go become a high school English teacher to prove to my parents that I could, you know, have a financially stable job, and to prove to them. I was just like, cool, I'm going to be a teacher. And I really did kind of want them, but it seemed like I was making that choice a lot for my parents. But as I was in, you know, my education courses, we put a lot on our teachers, and we also don't pay them enough. You know, it's like as in the country in whole, we should be paying our teachers an enormous amount more. And that's, I think, the paradox of the American public school system, is that we ask them for more than they can handle. You know, we've got teachers buying their own, you know, school supplies. So I think a grown man now, right? I can look back on her and the fact that she was a great teacher and look at this small little moment, which did, yes, it did kind of rip open my world. But I can see, like you had that experience, right, of acknowledging the fact that you were in the unknown.
Yeah, I did not know.
Yeah, and so that's I see the humanity of that, and I understand also the hardship of that job, and I have a tremendous, tremendous respect for the teachers in our country, mm-hmm. and all of my teachers.
Absolutely, and boy, the last year
they had on me.
The last year, I think we all know they're underpaid. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Brian Quijada, my guest, is the star of Where Do We Sit on the Bus? The goal, of course, was to be on stage at Jiva, but they are finding creative ways to reach you, and this one is a can't miss. I don't like doing that. I guarantee it, but I kind of guarantee that you will really appreciate Brian Quijada here. And so you can get tickets, and access is open now for the general public. Tickets on sale, and you can stream at jivatheater.org through Vimeo. So through March 7th. So Brian's our guest here, and we're talking about the show, which begins with you telling the story of an engagement and asking. Mm-hmm. Asking your fiance, like, how do you raise kids and help them learn about different heritage? You could have started in a lot of different places. You start there and you move into a performance of conception and delivery that take me through what you were trying to, you know, do here. Are you just trying to entertain the audience here? I'm mostly kidding, but tell the audience a little bit about this part of the show.
Are you talking about the engagement, or are you talking about?
Well, let's do both. You can take us through. Start with the engagement.
So the beginning of the show starts with me proposing to my now wife. At the time, I proposed to her on this, you know, extravagant trip to Mexico, where I proposed to her on the sand with turquoise water as a backdrop, and she said yes, and thankfully. And we came back, you know, from our little vacation, our engagement vacation, and kind of started having these real questions. She's half Austrian and half Swiss, and my family's all from the country of El Salvador. And I kind of had this breakdown of like, cool, first comes love, then comes marriage, and then comes a baby, right? In a baby carriage. And that led to, it started mining my own experiences, trying to find my own, racial identity. And here when we have children of our own, they're going to be mining half of mine and half of hers. And that's the entry point, right? I always consider a lot of, you know, the plays or books as having, you know, a chorus, a kind of a return to a theme or a return to a sentiment. And for me, that's what this play is. It's what is the story that I will pass on to my kids, like the stories that were passed on by my parents. That to me is the chorus of the play. It's to me the return, the major sentiment, right? And to really mine into that, I had to go from the very beginning of my story, which goes back to my parents conceiving me.
Nobody wants to think about that.
No, but it was necessary as an entry point. And I think also, you know, to pay homage, I think there's a lot of storytellers that do go back to the very beginning of their life, perhaps not as graphically, you know, it's I think paying homage to you know, the John Leguizamos, I forget, James Joyce, the Portrait of a Man. It's paying homage, I think, but it's it might be, surely. At the end of the day, it might just be for giggles.
Well, your mother in the show, through you, of course, you're doing everybody. You're doing all the characters. And your mother tells the story of, I'm trying to remember what she said, land sort of flat as a board under flowers to get across the border. Is that?
Yes.
Can you tell that story for the audience? I mean, just sure. the way you tell it in the show is amazing. And first, I want to listen to the clip, and I want to talk a little bit more about that. But can we listen to it, Rob? I think it's number two. Is that right, Megan? I just want to make sure. I think it's scene nine. Okay. Is that right? I think this is the clip.
Yeah.
I think that's right. All right, let's listen.
Ma, why did you come here? De money. My mother says she walked 3 days in the desert when she came. Helicopters would spot us by day, so we traveled only at night. A quarter of an apple and a half a sandwich to get us over the border. 3 days. She said she laid under a board covered with flowers on top in the back of a pickup truck to get through immigration. Why isn't there an Oregon Trail game that tells that story? We stayed stiff and quiet, but I made it to North Hollywood. I could see the Hollywood sign every day from work, a place where dreams are made. I arrived on a Saturday. I started work on Monday. I took care of a child in a house with a swimming pool. ¡Qué vida! But every time she would hear the sound of a helicopter, she says that she would run back inside, thinking that they were coming for her and breaking her dreams. Don't forget where you come from, she says. Protect your dreams. Protect my dreams.
That is from Brian Quijada's show, Where Do We Sit on the Bus? And there's a lot there that I want to talk about. First of all, just when you think about what your mother is describing, what she's going through in that actual scene across the border, what comes to mind for you as a first-generation American?
That's a great question, and a very weighty one, right? I think it's sacrifice, right? It's when I try to put myself in my parents' shoes of, you know, conceiving of what it took for them to strive for better lives and for better lives for their, you know, future children, to risk their lives and cross the border, you know, nearly die, right? It's in through a desert of 3 days. It gives me an appreciation, right, for my people, like my parents and immigrants who are just, you know, some looking for a better life, safety, what have you. It's the American dream. It's like it is the embodiment of the American dream in one way or another. In the show, I talk about, you know, going to the Statue of Liberty Museum, the Ellis Island, and walking through the museum and getting to those little computers. I don't know if you've ever been, but there's computers that have signatures, right, of every immigrant that came through. And I remember scrolling through, and it's in the show, right? And I know that our name wasn't in there, right? I know that our name, Quijada, was not in that database, but I so badly wanted to be a part of the greatest immigration story our country has. I so badly wanted it to be a part of, you know, the pride that we have, you know, give me your tired, you're poor, that it was so tragic to not find our names. And I knew our story. I just so badly wanted to be a part of it. Of you know, the great American motto, you know, of letting in those who are tempest-tossed. And so hearing that, it really puts everything into perspective, right? If anything, you know, in my life, I know that my parents went through, and she did it at 16 years old. So it's kind of, it helps put everything into perspective. Ugh. And you know, me and my parents, because my father did the same thing. But it's interesting to how we view the American dream, right? Their American dream was to be able to come and make a living, because in their country, it was just impossible, right? You just couldn't make a living. You work and work and work and work with really no, you can't gain anything. So their American pursuit was to be able to live a life and have a family and support their family. And what's interesting now is that the gift that they've given me is this kind of new age American dream of being a first generation of immigrant folks, is that my American dream is paying homage to that, and that I could do anything. It's not just be able to survive. It's that I can survive doing the thing that I love if I have enough passion to pursue it.
Well,
you know?
we'll get there, because it's not like your dad was thrilled about that, but we'll.
He was not.
So we're going to get there, because, you know, when you end this clip, you say, protect your dreams. I'm wondering whose dreams here, you know, dreams
exactly.
For you. But and look, that's a classic parent-child story, but especially for an immigrant family in these circumstances, you can understand it. You can understand, and we're going to get there in a second, but I want to return to one line that we just heard that I loved, that I want to ask you more about. When you say, you know, you're describing your mom coming across the border, 3 days of traveling only at night so the helicopters during the day wouldn't see her, coming mm-hmm. through the desert, staying stiff and quiet, laying under a board covered with flowers in the back of a pickup to come across the border. And you say, why isn't there an Oregon Trail game that tells that story?
Mm.
You know, you kind of dovetail that with the point you're making about going to Ellis Island, not seeing the family name, you know, not
right.
seeing the stories repped in classic media, even games like Oregon Trail. Do you feel like this country has lifted up and celebrated only one kind of narrative for a long time, and that gets reflected in popular media and games like that, where that's the heroic narrative, the Oregon Trail,
mm-hmm.
whereas your mother's story is either not known or viewed as sort of wrong or bad?
Sure. Yes. I mean, yes. And the hopeful thing is that I think a lot is changing, but, you know, and how we view these stories and how we're, I think, you know, in places all around the country, they're changing. Simple things as much as Christopher Columbus, right, to Indigenous Peoples Day, it's the Oregon Trail is something that, you know, just glorifies the white immigrant and in a lot of ways I now that 2020 happened in a huge year for I think awareness of racial injustice and just a general awareness and acknowledgement of you know, people are doing land acknowledgements now, which is really great. I think we are progressing, but I remember seeing a picture of the first Thanksgiving, right, where it was like this beautiful. There's a pilgrim shaking hands with a Native American. It's amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing, all right.
And it's amazing, right? You're just like, oh, my God, this is amazing. Look how good the pilgrims were. And then, you know, you read The People's History of the United States by Howard Zinn, and you're like, oh, yeah, yeah. And then the rape and pillaging happened. You know, or like, did this even happen, or is this – because it wasn't a real picture, right? It was drawn by some person who this is what we're feeding into the American school system. And so, yes, in a lot of ways, I do feel that passion, right, to bring awareness to it, to just call it out in saying that why is there an Oregon Trail game and not.
Yeah.
But I am hopeful, though, that we're progressing. And I think it's small steps. You know, progress is a slow-moving train, but it's even having that conversation with my third grade teacher over this show And, you know, she's still teaching, which is amazing. And it's bringing awareness to how we view these narratives and how we teach our young about our country's history.
Yeah. My son is going to be 9 in a month, and he thinks helicopters are so cool. We see helicopters in the sky, and it's like, cool. And, you know, like, honestly, your show is a reminder of just what advantage looks like. That, not to make him or me or anybody feel bad or guilty, but to understand that for your mother, hearing the sound of a helicopter meant, are they coming back to take me away? Mm-hmm. You know, it was reminiscent of her coming through the desert, just trying to find a chance at a life. For my kid, it's just cool, you know? I mean, like,
yeah,
I find that really instructive. I really do.
Sure. And, you know, everything is relative, right? Like, I think they're cool, too.
Yeah,
I think that's the,
exactly.
I think that's the thing is that it's I think the intent is not, it was never, it's never to be like, to feel bad, right? Like, it's like, don't feel bad about the fact that you might not. It's just know that on the other side, there is a different perspective,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah, and when we come back from break here, we're going to talk about some of those different perspectives that show up in schools and in lunchrooms, in social settings, trying to understand, you know, sort of where kids feel like they fit and what their identity means and what does it mean. What does it mean to not forget where you came from, and sort of what does that mean in that social setting? What does that mean when kids are looking at you? And all of that is explored in Brian Quijada's remarkable Where Do We Sit on the Bus? And you can see it now through Jiva and through Vimeo. So just go to jivatheater.org. You can get tickets. And so we're going to talk about all of that. And we're also going to talk about doing a one-man show and making it musical, really adding texture. I mean, this is a phenomenal performance. And we're going to talk more with Brian on the other side here. Coming up in our second hour, disability mentoring, especially aimed at young girls. Girls with disabilities don't work nearly at the same rate of people who do not have disabilities. Girls with disabilities have lower self-esteem, self-image problems, and don't often have mentors. So an organization is seeking to change all of that, and the stories are frankly amazing. You're going to hear them next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and my guest is Brian Quijada, star of Where Do We Sit on the Bus, that you can see through jivatheater.org. And if not for this pesky pandemic, you could have seen him in person. But Brian is the kind of talent that eventually, I suspect, we will all see him in a lot of different places. I want to listen to another clip from Brian's show. And Brian will take you through it in the clip himself. And then we're going to talk about kids and fitting in and identity and all of these sort of complicated things. Let's listen.
Within seconds, we're separated to a class at the end of the hall filled with brown children. Class full of brown kids like me, like the kids in my old neighborhood. I start scoping out who my future friends will be. All the brown children have Spanish-speaking parents like mine with them. Small room is packed. Quiet down! English as a second language, the teacher says. The principal walks in and seems flustered, looks at all of us like we're a bunch of numbers, says that we all won't fit in that one class. The man walks up to my mom fast and asks, what's his name? Brian? Oh, Brian. Oh, so he can speak English, right? Yes, yes, he learned from his brothers. Good. We're gonna go ahead and put him in the regular class. And just like that, I moved to a white kid class with a teacher that doesn't fully understand my half in Spanish, half in English questions. When will my mom recoger me? What? Sit down. I do.
There's a scene from Where Did We Sit on the Bus that I'm going to ask Brian to tell you a little bit more about that moment and what you hope people will take from that kind of a scene, Brian.
Sure. So when my parents, you know, the first house that we ever had to was moved to when I was born was a mobile home in Glendale, Illinois. And, you know, after my parents hustled, worked their butt off, we were able to move to a house with no wheels in a town called Highwood, Illinois. And when I went to school, I like to say it's like it was like reverse gentrification. It was like we were the first Latinos in our block. And if you go back to our block, it's mostly Latino now. But at the time, it was, you know, I was there was like one little class, an ESL class, English for Spanish. What does ESL stand for? English
as a
second language.
As a second
right?
language, yeah.
Yeah. And it was a little small class, and it was just packed. It had too many people in it, so I was moved. And at the time, my parents didn't allow us to speak English in the house because they wanted us to learn Spanish. My brother already had started speaking English in the house, and he would reply to my parents in English, and they're like, "No, you have to speak Spanish because we don't want you to lose it," which to this day is one of the greatest gifts they've ever given me, aside from life. I'm very thankful that they kept Spanish in our. You know, I speak Spanish fluently. When we go to El Salvador, they're like, "These guys speak English." Which is an amazing feeling, right? Because of that, they were like, "You'll learn English in school." And so I got to class, and here I was, you know, speaking Spanglish, trying to, you know, string together any words that I could to try and navigate being in school for the first time. But it was a wild experience, and I think the way of telling it, this kind of the music that you hear behind it is. It's all in the style of the narrative, this very fast paced music, very, you know, the story driven by the beat of the music that I'm making live on stage.
It's riveting. It is just fantastic to see the way you execute some of that, the loops of music and the sound and the way you sort of weave in from dialogue to sort of spoken word poetry, and there's just a phenomenal flow to it. And you, as you talk about the surprise that people might have when you speak English so well, it's sort of heartbreaking to think about, Brian. I'm not trying to be trite here, but a society in which some kids walk into a store or walking through a store would be asked to empty their backpack to prove they didn't steal anything based on the color of their skin or what their voice might sound like. And it's almost heartbreaking that like, "Hey man, can you empty your backpack? I want to see." And then you speak and they go, "Oh, your English is really good." It's almost like, "Oh, I guess I didn't need to ask you," which is just awful. But
yeah.
can you weigh in on that?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's, in the end of the day, I don't go to, you know, sleep being like, "Oh, I'm a brown skinned man, you know, and this is my, you know, my, this is my family history and this is my lineage and this is who we kind of fit." You know, I go to sleep just being like, "I'm just a dude. I'm just a guy. I'm just a guy living my life here and going to work every day." And but there are those moments where, you know, I'm speaking and somebody's just like, "Whoa, you sound like a white guy," or like being on the phone, you're just like, "You sound like a white guy," or like being in a grocery store and having a very traumatic experience of being asked to empty my bag, just probably because he was, you know, I was being profiled. And it's a very rude awakening, right? It's those moments are like a rude awakening in life in general of being like, "No, I am who I am in this body." And it comes with all of the stereotypes that people have. And it comes with, all of this preconceived notions of what it means to be somebody in my body. And, I think that's just, you know, the life. And, you know, I even still I can say, "Yeah, but I still I'm still a lighter skinned, you know, BIPOC," but BIPOC is a term for Black, Indigenous, or person of color person. And so I still have a certain amount of privilege, mm-hmm. right? I've never been pulled over by the police, And I don't know if that's because I'm an incredible driver, or because I'm light skinned. That's just kind of everyday thoughts when something like that happens.
Yeah.
But in the end of the day, what I think is it stays true, I think, to what I'm surprised by with people hearing that story is finding universality in it, even if they're not. I've had people come up to me and be like, hey, I don't speak a lick of Spanish, but my parents were Italian and they experienced the same thing that your family did. Mm-hmm. I relate to your story because I also love Michael Jackson. Do you know what I mean? It's this, we find ourselves, sure. My experiences are different or unique in their perspective, but it's also there's so much, I've been surprised by in commonalities that I have conversations with the audience members.
Well, speaking of Michael Jackson and of great driving, I'm thinking about, I'm thinking about a kid whose father drives a truck 15 hours a day, knowing that if he gets pulled over, a dream could be gone. Works just seeming like forever to make sure that what he's building in this country will be different than what he and previous generations experienced elsewhere. And then to see his kid decide, now, I kind of want to sing and dance. But you loved Michael Jackson, huh?
I do. God, I do. Listen, and he's a controversial person to like right now. There was a moment there where I really couldn't listen to Michael Jackson. But it's very hard to grow up with somebody who has influenced your musical taste, your love of melody and of course, before he's the king of pop. It is a very complicated feeling, but I cannot separate the fact that he has influenced so much of my work. I do a mean moonwalk.
And you also do a great character in a father who maybe isn't sure that you should be, like, what are you going to do with your life? How much did you, wrestle and worry about that? And what was that experience like in your family? That sort of, we see some of that on the stage, but tell the listeners about what that experience is like for an immigrant family that just wants to not only value hard work, but make sure that whatever you are doing is going to put you in a good position to be okay, to be, to make money, to have a career.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's tough because, I think everybody or a lot of us, we just want to make our parents proud. We just want to feel that affirmation of, we love what you're doing and keep going. Everybody wants to feel the support of their parents. And when I decided to pursue theater, it did not go over well. It makes sense, right, to me, because my parents didn't know any artists that made their living off of theater, right? They didn't know. They don't know anybody personally who can be like, yeah, Brian will be okay. They were like, you're going to starve and we don't want you to starve. So pick something that is like secure. And it makes sense, right? They just don't want me to die. I get that. But I think what they perhaps didn't see was that I think their work ethic is hereditary. I think they passed off their hard work and that drive to put everything into the work to pursue the dream. It passed on to me, and I work so hard on my own craft, which is I say in the show that my father considers art a luxury, and I consider it a necessity. Mm-hmm. And so I put just as much work, into it as he put into his work. I think I'm grateful that he taught us about hard work and to value all the time and energy and focus that it takes to be proud of the work that you make. So it was very tough, and I think this show honestly is one that did open specifically my dad. My dad was the big one who was very much against my pursuit. But there was a moment there where he came to see him. I remember there was a time where he came to see a very very early draft. It was like a new play workshop in Chicago, and he came to see it, and it was free, right? And it was the first time that he was seeing it, and I was so nervous for him to come and see it, because obviously the play, you know, I wouldn't say it paints him as the antagonist, right? And he came to see it, and afterwards, you know, I'm getting hugs from everybody. There's food, there's wine, everybody's having a good time, and my dad is waiting in the corner. And I walk up to him afterwards, and I'm just like, hi. He's just like, hi. And I'm like, what'd you think? And he's like, I'm going to tell you a story. And I'm like, okay. And he's just like, a guy just came up to me, and he asked me if I was your dad. And I said, yes. And I'm like, okay. And he's just like, the guy said to my dad, he was just like, your son is amazing. You should be so proud. And the guy continues on. He's just like, I just went to go see this other play at one of the big Chicago theaters. I don't remember where. I paid $60 for that play, and that play sucked. And I saw this play tonight for free. This is amazing. Pause for a second. And he's just like, Brian, you could really make a lot of money doing this play.
That's the validation, right?
Validation, I think, and it's, you know, it's insight into how my, you know, the how my dad mind works, but it's also a beautiful thing that it was his first kind of eye-opening experience where he's just like, oh, my son could actually make a living doing this, you know.
Wow. What? He didn't tell you he loved the play. He just said you can make some money with it. I hope he loved it.
No, he loves it. It's really nice. You know, I've gone on tour with this play for a few years now, and he always calls me, and he's just like, where are you now? And how, you know, it must be like, I mean, it must be beautiful, right? For him, that I'm kind of going around the country, Boise, Pittsburgh, New York, and telling his story. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something that gives him an incredible joy that his story is being told to strangers all across the country.
Well, I mean, I'm sure he's heard enough of you in media, but if he ever listens to this interview in Rochester, New York, I hope he understands what a better country this is because of people like him and the hard work and the sacrifice that he and your mother and so many others have made. It's beautiful. And you know, you ask a question at one point, Brian, you know, you ask, why is this country so incredibly fear driven? And as you mentioned earlier this hour, this country has sort of shifted its targets over the decades. Italians have experienced this, as you mentioned, Irish people, Catholics, people of obviously different religious backgrounds, various mm-hmm. religious backgrounds. Now, of course, you know, we see where a lot of the pain and inequality lies. And you ask, why is this country so incredibly fear-driven? What is your conclusion on that?
The thought on this is a very wise lesson that I learned in my choral class. It's in the show, but it kind of there's double meaning behind it. I wanted to learn how to sing because I wanted to do theater, and the only theater that I could do were musicals, because at the time that's the only thing that's really no middle school decides to do Death of a Salesman. they do Annie, you know, they do The Wizard of Oz, they do musicals. So I was just like, oh man, I better learn how to sing. And when I was in chorus, it was a lesson. I'm a bass, right? I don't know if you can hear from my voice, but I sing pretty low, and I had to learn the harmony. I had to learn the lower harmony, which was never the melody. It's never what you recognize on the radio. It's always just like, it's just like weird. It doesn't make sense. And I hated it. And what I learned from that moment is that everybody learns their separate parts, right? Is that the outcome is gorgeous. It's this beautiful four-part, six-part, what have you, however it's arranged, beautiful harmony, this amazing coming together of voices from in different octaves and different, you know, notes. It's beautiful. And it's then that my teacher was just it kind of hits that we were learning how to harmonize, and harmony must be taught. It's so hard to just, I mean, some savants, right, can, you know, tell you what the, can, the, you know, perfect pitch, can tell you what a note is, maybe can naturally harmonize, but I had to learn how to harmonize. And I think that's, in the end of the day, that's, I think, the philosophy that I kind of live by in this wider scale, this worldview, is that you have to teach harmony. In the same way that harmony is taught, so is hate and so is fear. And so it's just about reteaching, trying, doing your darndest to try and reteach that that harmony is achievable. You know, that fear must be untaught and hate must be untaught, because it's hate is fear, right? And so that's my whole world philosophy, is that, yeah, there's a lot of work to be done and everywhere, right around the world, in our country, and I will let that that high school perspective of harmony leading the way guide me.
I love it. Brian Quijada, my guest, is the star of Where Did We Sit on the Bus? You can see it through Jiva Theater, jivatheater.org. Tickets on sale now, and you can stream it through March 7th. And they've got a couple of free public engagement events taking place next week as part of the Amplify series of community conversations. So this coming Monday, 7:30 p.m. on Zoom, Reclaiming the Narrative, the Future of Latinx Representation on Stage and Screen. Brian will be part of that, along with Hilary Bettis, Mary Mendez Rizzo, Raul Torres. Then on Wednesday, next Wednesday, 7 p.m. on Zoom, it's Relearning History, the Complexity and Origins of Latinx Identity in the United States, with Dr. Hilda Chacon, Dr. Isabel Cordova, Julio Sainz, and Dr. Joseph Vieira. So you get a couple of events, free events next week, but also just a chance to see Brian's show. And we've been talking about some heavy themes, but maybe in the last few minutes, we should emphasize an important point. For an artist and an entertainer like Brian, you don't have a chance to make a living if you're not entertaining. And this is just a fabulous one-person show. I have to ask you, everything that you're putting into this, the movement, the characters, the voices, the singing, the spoken word, the looped music and sound that you use so effectively, all of those things, you make it look easy, and I'm sure you've done it many times. The first time that you're doing a show like this, one person, and you got to do it in front of people, what was that like?
Oh, terrifying.
I have to imagine.
Terrifying. It with like anything, right? It takes practice, and the more you do it, the more comfortable you become doing it. But even still, you know, it's incredibly terrifying to bare your soul in front of mostly strangers, right? I think the fact that I use comedy as a shield a lot, you know, it's like I also love, you know, I'm a huge fan of stand-up comedians and incredible I respect for stand-ups, and so adding jokes and adding dance and adding kind of all the things that I love doing were added in there just to be like, cool, let's talk about why I love these things, and let's try to put on a show for people. And it's been an incredible journey, I think, trying to jam pack a show with these hard questions that are important, right? And also expressing the joy, right? The joy of
there's a lot of joy. There's a lot of joy.
There's so much joy. And I think that's what's amazing, is that in the end of the day, I'm an optimist, and I am the most hopeful of anybody. And so it's incredible to be able to tell these stories and to, yes, talk about some hard hitting subjects, but also, you know, in the end of the day, it's all to, you know, make. There's the conception is in there for a reason.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't make you giggle.
Oh, my gosh. It is so joyful. Our producer, Megan Mack, is someone who has, I don't know if listeners know this, but studied in comedy, has really worked with some of the really luminous people in the field, could have done that herself. We're graced with her presence here in Rochester. And she is really tough, man. Like, she doesn't like much. And she was watching this before I had a chance to see it, and she said, "You are not going to believe how good he is." So, I mean, I know.
That's very sweet.
So last 30 seconds, what is the most stirring piece of feedback you've gotten from the show? 30 seconds.
What is the most stirring piece of feedback?
Yeah, from just maybe just a viewer or someone who checked it out.
Sure. You know, it's I think it's that is that I've gotten, you know, people who want to know the answer. And though I answer very, very quickly at the end, the where did we sit on the bus? It's complicated for me, but I say I would have sat in the back. Right. And I think what I am inspired by is that a story like this, that where people are like, cool, what is the answer? Will you ever answer it? It leads to people going to go do the research on their own and to educate themselves, yeah. Right? It's an amazing thing. And to have a good time watching the show while they're also educating themselves. It's a marvelous, marvelous thing.
Everyone should see it. Brian Quijada, star of Where Did We Sit on the Bus, that you can see through JivaTheater.org now. Sorry we couldn't see you in person, but this is the next best thing. Thank you for the time, and good luck to you, Brian.
Thank you for having me so much.
What a great conversation. What a phenomenal performer he is. More connections coming up in a moment.